This is the second day of this December 2017 four-day session. I'm going to continue with Sheng Yan, but from a different book. This one is entitled Attaining the Way, A Guide to the Practice of Chan Buddhism. It includes selections from four different masters, but the final selection is Sheng Yan's own words, and I'm going to be reading from that. It was basically compiled from four different sesshins that he gave in the early 1990s. They've sort of been blended together under different topics, and I'm going to launch right in. So this first section is called Preparing to Practice, and I think it comes from opening day of a session. In fact, it says, the title of it is Give Your Body to the Cushion. And it begins, this is the first morning of a seven-day intensive Chan meditation retreat. In Japanese Zen, this is called Sesshin, which comes from the Chinese Shesin, not sure about that, of course, meaning to collect one's mind into a continuous meditative stream, basically to collect one's mind. Very simply, that's what we're here to do. Some of you are attending retreat for the first time. It's not the case here for us. Everybody here has been to Sesshin before. But for Sheng Yan, some of you are attending retreat for the first time. For some, this is an unfamiliar place. The noises of New York City never stop. This is his center that was in Queens, so I guess it still is in Queens. Sheng Yan himself died a few years back. I should say, before I get into this further, could have mentioned this yesterday, both PK, both Philip Kaplow, Roshi Kaplow, and Bodhin Roshi, have spent time with Sheng Yan, and very friendly relations between both our centers. I think really what his stream of Zen represents is, number one, really down-to-earth, straightforward, and very upright. There's a lot of emphasis on proper conduct, on the precepts, on repentance. It's kind of refreshing. Anyway, the noises of New York City never stop. Therefore, it is normal to feel nervous or anxious. My best advice is to just relax. For 7 days, you also have your body to contend with. Most of you will suffer from leg and back pains, just like here. You may get tired or sleepy. Again, relax. Your body and your mind will adjust quickly if you do not resist. It's a very good point. We say relax, and I'm not sure we always understand what we mean by that, but it's really not to resist. So much of our problems come from wanting things to be different than they are, and worrying about how things may become different in some way that we don't like. It's not the spirit of Zen. We take things as they are. And it's a practical thing to do, because when we don't resist, then pains and drowsiness aren't quite so difficult to deal with. He says, make a firm commitment to focus, to leave thoughts of past and future outside these doors. You can, and certainly will, return to your issues after retreat. But right now, thoughts about them will hinder your practice. It's not only in Sesshin, that it's unskillful, let's say, to worry about things that we aren't dealing with at the moment, problems at work or problems with family or relationships. They'll all be there, as he says, when we get out. But even in our daily life, spend so much time worrying and dealing with anxiety about things that we can't control. We need to think about our problems clearly. You need to plan. You need to focus. You need not to shove things into the back of your mind because it's painful to think about them. But on the other hand, what many of us do is spend way too much time chewing over the same sad material. Anxiety, insomnia, those are problems of thoughts that we can't control. And what we're doing here is learning how to deal with our thoughts. He says, at all times, keep your mind on your method of practice. When wandering thoughts appear, do not follow them, simply recognize them and return to the method. I think we may have heard this one or two times already. Know that once you identify a wandering thought for what it is, you are no longer on that thought. This is a really good point. It's you can't be having a thought and recognize that you're having a thought at the same time. They don't happen at the same time. So the minute you've identified a thought, that thought is past. Then the question is, are you going to follow it up with more thoughts on the same topic, shall we say, or are you going to return to your practice? It says, if you can do this, I guarantee you will have no anxiety over wandering thoughts. Just identify them for what they are. Decide now not to be concerned with concepts or physical sensations, both real and imagined. Just focus on the method. That is easier said than done, but if you can do it, time will fly. On the other hand, preoccupation with your thoughts and your body will cause the time to drag, and you'll experience a lot of discomfort. Something many of us have experienced. Then he says something else that's really significant. He says, do not expect to gain anything. Forget any expectations you may have about practice. The practice itself is your goal. And by being here, you've already achieved that. Continue to make it a reality. So hard to do. Just want to practice for its own sake. He points this out. How effective would a worker be if the only thing he or she thought about was the check at the end of the month? So do not think about what you'll get by being here or where you'll be after the retreat. Just focus on your purpose, which is to meditate. So this first day's theme is to relax your body and your mind. Take to heart the saying, give your body to the cushion and your mind to the method. If you do that, the rest will take care of itself. I'm skipping ahead a bit. This is a section that's called Be Mindful of Impermanence. And he says, when I was a child, time passed slowly. I had to wait so long to be a year older. When I became an adult, time passed very quickly. Now I have lived 63 years in vain, and time flies ever faster. The Buddha spoke of impermanence, and the Chan patriarchs spoke of sudden enlightenment. If you do not study Buddha Dharma, you will not know impermanence. And if you do not cultivate practice, you will not know sudden enlightenment. When Shakyamuni Buddha first turned the Dharma wheel at Deer Park, he taught impermanence. Before entering Nirvana, he reminded his disciples that whatever is born must perish. Birth, death, and impermanence characterize worldly existence. It is only in the liberation of Nirvana that birth and death perish. If you do not practice toward genuine realization, how can you escape the delusive snares of the demons of impermanence? Every day in the evening session, we recite Bodhisattva Samantabhadra's warning. This is their version of even as night. It goes like this. This day has passed. Our lives, too, are closing. Like fish in shallow water, joy will not last. Let us work with pure effort as if our heads were aflame. Be mindful of impermanence. Beware of idleness. Let us work with pure effort as if our heads were on fire. This admonition used to really bother me because it sounds like what we're being told is to freak out and put out some sort of, you know, you imagine somebody screaming and rolling on the floor and flames shooting out of their ears. But what I've come to understand it is, don't waste a minute. When we absolutely see the situation as it is, then we're not going to take our time. We're not going to sit back and wait. Wait until we're in the mood. I had an experience once. My family, my wife and I and our kids, Ivan and Sasha, were all down in a cabin that we had down near the Pennsylvania border. And had driven the car up the hill. It was sort of a rutted road that followed a ravine, and parked it in front of the cabin. And I was sitting inside, sitting in a chair, door was open, and I glanced up from my book to see the car with Ivan in the front seat rolling backwards towards the ravine. As it rolled out of the frame of the door, I jumped out of the chair and raced up, sort of running alongside the car. I was able to open the door, throw Ivan over to the other side of the front seat, get in. The brake pedal looked gigantic, and just slammed on the brake. And even though I had saved him, he was irritated that I had thrown him to the other side of the seat. But it's just one of those things, you know, that was just, it just happened because the urgency was pretty clear. It's as he says, as he's going to say, it's so easy to avoid knowing our situation. You don't want to become morbid. But Buddhism is realistic. We talk about death, we talk about impermanence because that's what's here, that's what life is. It's the reason why life is so precious. Only have this one life. Xing Yin says, life is too short. Time passes too quickly. If we do not value the time and work as hard as we should, we will miss our chance. If we are alert to the brevity of life, we will not waste our precious time afflicting ourselves and others, dealing with affirmation and denial, benefit and harm, gain and loss. As you practice Chan, if every thought is imbued with a sense of impermanence, you will transform delusion into mindfulness. It's a common experience that people have when they come close to death. Suddenly things become clear. I had an old friend in high school Hadn't seen him for a decade or two, probably 20 years. And we met again. He'd actually taken up the study of Tai Chi. He's actually a Tai Chi teacher. But before he got heavily into that, he worked as a TV, producer. And at some point he had a job with CNN, and then he was assigned to this group that was getting another network established, FNN, the Financial News Network. And he told me that for a year they worked 7 days a week. I think 7 days a week, 12 hours a day anyway, was a tremendous effort to get everything done. The people who were funding the enterprise needed it done by a certain time, probably for some bogus tax reason. But at any rate, they worked like crazy. And once it was up and running, everybody got a vacation. And he went off on vacation with his wife, family. And as often happens, after just a few days, he had a heart attack. Stress finally kicked up, and it wasn't certain whether he was going to live or die. So he remembers being on the gurney, and at work, he had had a difficult relationship with someone else, a co-worker, and he realized, I have to forgive this person. I can't die without forgiving him. And so he did, laying on the gurney. And then when he survived and everything was okay, he went back and he said he did. He went up and apologized for his side of the difficulty, because we're always at least partly to blame for those sorts of difficult situations. The fellow he was apologizing to, I don't think really knew what to do with it, but nevertheless, for him, it was meaningful. Xingyan says, there are people at this retreat who have practiced Chan for 20 or more years without losing faith. This is rare and precious, and there must be a profound reason. Many have stayed in temples and Buddhist centers and have gone to one or more intensive retreats a year. But did they practice every single moment during that time? In their ordinary lives, most meditate an hour or so a day. Otherwise, they're busy with their lives, their families, their work, busy with delusions, afflictions, and boredom. What does it mean, then, to say that someone has practiced for 20 or more years? During a 7-day retreat, even though you are in the Chan Hall from morning to night, please clarify for yourselves how much of this time is actually occupied by delusions, oblivion, and scattered thoughts. How much of this time is spent in wholehearted meditation? If you truly understood that the time you actually practice is not really that much, you would determine not to slacken and to begin making energetic progress. It can be painful to realize how much of our time we waste. It's not something that we need to feel there is something wrong with us, but it's not abnormal. Everybody struggles. It's just so hard to do this simple practice. But we can't be satisfied with just going through the motions. You can't sort of give in to, well, I tend to sort of wander a bit, on day two, or there's certain thoughts that I have difficulty putting down, and so I stay with them for a while, or need to really look at that, and need to, even if we fail, we need to commit to giving that up as soon as we notice, to come back. That has to be our goal. That has to be our intention. Don't have to get depressed because we fail. Just have to be determined that you're going to get it right. You're going to find a way. It's that saying in Japanese Zen, 7 times down, 8 times up. Such is life. Seven hundred times down, 701 times up. She says, so I ask all of you before sitting, bow to your cushion, your Bodhi mandala, that is your place of enlightenment, and say to yourself, I vow to use all of my time on meditation. After you sit, make another vow. I vow to put my whole being into my practice. In this manner, you will develop mindfulness and understand impermanence. Shengyan uses vows quite a bit, and the way he explains it makes sense to me when I read it. We make these vows even though we know we may not be able to fulfill them. This is certainly true for the four vows. It's true for us, for the precepts. And yet, we make this vow. And when we fail, we vow again. We try again. Skipping ahead again. This section is called When the Meditation Work is Thoroughly Fused. He says, when you sit in meditation, your mind typically passes through states of relatively deeper concentration. At the first stage, stray thoughts are numerous, and even when you notice them, there is no awareness of their origin or extinction. They're just there. At this point, you are still not really putting your whole mind on your method. At the next stage, when you become aware of the rise and fall of stray thoughts, you are engaged. In other words, really using the meditation method. It doesn't say that the stray thoughts don't continue to arise, but now you see them. In the third stage, you really don't see thoughts being born and extinguished. There aren't any because your mind is totally on the method. Now you are meditating very well indeed. When you meditate, you may hope to reach this third stage, but the probability is not too great, especially if you anticipate it. When wandering thoughts arise, be neutral in your feelings. Do not be angry or irritated. Very important. Don't be angry or irritated. There's a saying that to be a Buddhist is to be happy to see your afflictions arise. The thoughts arise, and then we have a chance to work with them. We have a chance, and working with them means drop them. So many thoughts that have arisen, never been questioned, gone along with them, we bought into them. Thoughts about ourself, about our relative worth, either great or low, doesn't really make a difference in terms of how delusive it is. All our pet thoughts, those are the ones that come up. They come up because we've thought them so many times. We've created this karma. The only way those thoughts will cease arising, especially the ones that torture you, the ones that drive you nuts, the only way they're going to stop arising is if you create the habit of dropping them. In order to do that, they have to arise. So there's no need to be angry or irritated. It's just the work you have to do. Moment to moment birth and extinction means that once wandering thoughts are born, they will spontaneously melt away. If you don't oppose or worry about them, they will just fade away. So if you don't buy into them. What is most important is to begin again. Every wandering thought is an opportunity to begin again, because by the time you notice it, the thought is already dying and the next one has not been born. Therefore, each present now is a new beginning. Here's an analogy. When a mountain climber ascends a dangerous cliff, he must not look too far ahead or behind, or else he may lose his footing. If this should happen, he has to grab the ropes he has secured with the pitons and immediately pull himself back to the spot from which he slipped. Then he can continue his ascent. So for the climber, every step must be held fast. Every step is a new beginning. Meditation is like this. This is one of the reasons that people climb is because you have to be so present. Remember reading about some of the people who went on the disastrous trip up Mount Everest. Several books were written about it, where a number of people died. And for some of them, that was the only way they could deal with their depression, was to climb. Even though it was so painful and difficult, because you just had to be there completely. And really, meditation, when it's done properly, it's just like that. Of course, when we slip, we don't actually physically fall, at least not too many people do. I do know one person who fell backwards off the ton, but it's pretty rare. Each rising and falling thought is a movement forward, and each new beginning is another step in completing the meditation work. When you use a method the first time, your thoughts will often stray. As you gain experience, you will become aware of passing thoughts without losing the method. So approach it in this manner. The first thought is on the method, and so are the second, the third, the thousandth, and so on. If you sustain this without a break, that is called, quote, meditation work closely continuous. When there are no thoughts, there is only the method. When even the method is gone, you reach the stage where the meditation work is thoroughly fused. This next section is called External versus Internal Obstructions. One major source of obstructions is external, from the environment. Obvious examples are family or livelihood, which can get in the way of practice. The other major source of obstructions is internal, from within oneself. Of the two, external obstructions are comparatively trivial. They are more easily overcome. I knew a monk who returned to lay life and began working. He then abandoned his practice because he felt overwhelmed by work. On the other hand, I know a lay person who has an equally demanding job, and he says that, in fact, the job encourages him to practice better. Even if the jobs were similar, why should they have opposite effects on two different people? The answer is that the environment is only a minor aspect of one's obstructions. The more difficult obstructions are created by the mind. This is something that people don't want to admit. We really want to have this tendency to want to keep our focus outside ourselves, to see our problems as coming from the outside. But it's a really good practice to think about how someone else might handle this difficulty. This fellow Anthony DeMello that I read from quite frequently, my favorite Jesuit priest, actually a big turning point in his life was when he met a man in India who was dying of cancer, totally impoverished, living in poverty in the slums, and completely happy, radiant. He realized it's not the situation, it's not the circumstances. Shengyan says, keeping a humble attitude helps us to practice anywhere, anytime, whether in the Chan Hall or in the workplace. such a doesn't say a whole lot about it, but this word humble, it's so refreshing to meet someone who's just naturally humble, who has that humility. To the degree that we ourselves can feel a sense of humility, it relieves so many burdens. Number one, you don't have to measure up to some status that you secretly don't believe you deserve. It means that you're not going to be rubbing up angrily against other people. It means you just have a sense of proportion. You know, another thing Anthony DeMello is fond of saying is there used to be this there's this book that was written back, I don't know whether it was in the 60s or the 70s. It's called I'm Okay, You're Okay. It's basically a way of feeling okay about yourself, which I guess many people need to do because a lot of people don't feel that they're okay. But he said he wants to write a book called I'm an Ass, You're an Ass. Because that's the reality. We all screw up. We're all self-preferential. We all think of ourselves first. You look at a group picture, and I don't know about you, but I look at me. How do I look there? It's kind of petty. as he says, it's the small me. It's not the big I. It's the small self and not the large self, not the great self. It's such a relief to shift into realizing, okay, I take to heart what I do, I want to do my best, but I'm not going to pretend I'm something more than I am. Working from where I am. It's when there's this mismatch between what you think you have to be or what you think you are, and the reality of your actions and behaviors, that we get into trouble. So he says, keeping a humble attitude helps us to practice anywhere, anytime, whether in the Chan Hall or in the workplace. This comes to pass simply by radically reducing opportunities for strife, conflict, and the side effects of egotism. Also, if you maintain the impetus to generate Bodhi mind, that is, to see into the truth, see into our nature, everyone you meet will be a recipient of your compassion as well as a source of help. Not just every person, but every situation. One situation may cause aversion in one person, yet be an opportunity to practice to another. It depends on your attitude. We practice Chan to transform ourselves, not to change the environment. Once we're transformed, the environment, as an extension of ourselves, transforms as well. Thus, we can positively influence all we encounter. You know, sometimes people feel uncomfortable with going to a sesshin, taking time out for practice. Maybe I should be doing other things to help people take some kind of action. And those are good things to do, but it's profound, the help that we give to other people by changing ourselves. Because really, we're part of the problem. Our selfishness, our anxiety, our anger, all these things, it's a poison. We basically take the poison that's inside and it leaks out to the outside. So what with the work we do in sesshin, the work we do on the mat, changes ourselves and it changes others. In the repentance ceremony, which comes from Zen Master Dogen, we even say it changes inanimate things. It changes things in ways we don't even understand. The next section is called How Soon Enlightenment. People want to know how long it takes to become enlightened. The answer is a second, an hour, a year, a lifetime, many lifetimes. In ordinary matters, someone might achieve in an hour what takes another a week. One person with a single phrase might save a million people, whereas another might not help a single person in a lifetime. Rather than waste time and energy speculating, practitioners should give thought to their level of diligence and their karmic obstructions. Obstructions have been accumulating since time without beginning and carried in our minds through life after life. The bad as well as the good karma that we have created is carried within our minds. Ceaselessly, thought after thought, we carry these karmic debts and credits. We continue to attach ourselves. This is what drives us on. Our obstructions to practice should be the focus of our concern, not how long it takes to become enlightened. This next section is called As Clearly as the Palm of Your Hand. Inner observation of the mind's direction is awareness. Knowing at all times what your thoughts are doing, whether you are focused on the method, lost in illusory thought, or not clear what you are doing. If you can see these conditions of your mind as clearly as the palm of your hand, you are really practicing Chan. If you can ignore your body but observe your mind, if you can ignore external objects but observe the movement of your thoughts, you will soon forget time and space. When you observe your inner thoughts, their numbers will diminish, time will contract, space will expand, and your body and mind will lighten. When you are counting breaths, you are, of course, practicing. Realizing that you are practicing is awareness. You manage to continue practicing even as intentional or random thoughts keep trying to break in. Holding on to the awareness that you are practicing while the practice continues without a break, this is practicing Chan. Proceed in this mode, whatever method you are using. Counting the breath or following the breath, working on a koan, shikantaza. When you are extremely clear about what you are doing, it's as though you are observing yourself or someone is observing you. At this opportune time, without tensing, maintain your mental clarity and hold fast to the method. As simple as this may sound, not all can do it. People who don't know how to meditate make a great physical and mental effort to control themselves, but this is misguided and ineffective. Effective Chan practice requires balancing on a fine point between relaxation and dullness. To practice for more than a few periods in succession, much less days without tiring, you need to be relaxed, both in mind and in body. Otherwise, physical and mental exhaustion will overtake you. On the other hand, while relaxing the body and mind, you must guard against dullness. If you can manage this balance, the energy that is freed up can be channeled into the method and nourish your dedication to the way. After practicing one method for a long time, you may become bored and feel you are just spinning your wheels. It is like driving a car across the heartland of America. Hour after hour, the scenery seems the same. You aren't even aware how fast you're going. Then, suddenly, you arrive. In the same way, though you may be practicing well, it may not seem like you're making any progress. If, however, you generate the power to go on If need be, suddenly you will arrive. So do not give in to boredom. It may actually be a sign you're practicing well. On the other hand, please recognize that if you get excited when you sense you are making progress, you're in danger of losing the method. This is a good point, and most people get tripped up by this a number of times before they finally get it straight. It can be extremely exciting when things begin to shift. Time, the nature of time seems to change. Feel that flow and oneness. The body becomes so much lighter. If you focus on that, this is really no different than focusing on bad conditions. Good conditions, bad conditions, want to leave them be either way. It's obviously pleasant when we start making progress, but if we pay too much attention to that, other than just noticing it, then that takes the place of the method, of the practice. It takes the place of the breath or the koan. And therefore, the causes that have created that condition no longer obtain, and it will pass. Mental conditions, physical conditions, are always temporary. They never stay the same. Everything moves and shifts. He says, avoid both emotional extremes and simply rely on your determination to continue. Think of yourself as a trailblazer carving a path through wilderness. After you have surmounted obstacles and bypassed dangers on the way to your destination, the path will no longer seem so forbidding. Although obstructions still lurk, your experience in dealing with them will render them harmless. Your objectives are to learn correct attitudes for practice and to become thoroughly familiar with your method. This requires continuous dedication to a long process. Your gains will be diligence, perseverance, and patience. All these benefits cannot help but improve your life and your practice. Okay. I think that says it pretty well. Our time is up. And we'll now recite the four vows.
Buddha, I vow to attain.